Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 AM or 97.5 on the FM dial. You can also live stream us at kfar.com. This is Problem Corner. I am your guest host, Nick Nugent, filling in for Dave Pruse. If you would like to call in, you can do so by dialing 458-TALK or 458-8255. We'll try to get to your call. Today is Wednesday, so our topic will be something historical, and we have a really good show lined up this morning, I hope. Today we have myself, Joan Skilbred, who is normally in, is off traveling. So today's topic are going to be some early aviation, and we'll start with the 1924 Douglas World Cruisers flight, something that didn't take place in Fairbanks, but certainly the entire length of coastal Alaska and out through the Aleutians. So the year was 1924, and little progress had been made on a globe-circling flight. That was sort of the holy grail, if you will, for flyers of those days. Trans-channel flights, flights across the Mediterranean, and other flights had been made. So in 1922, an English aviator, Major Blake, had made the attempt to reach the United States by way of the Aleutians. He made it as far as Calcutta, leaving from England, where he fell seriously ill and was replaced by Captain Norman McMillan, who failed to complete the flight. Sir Ross Smith and his brother, Sir Keith Smith, planned a flight from Great Britain, and this came to nothing when Sir Ross was killed in a plane crash during preparations. Major Blake and Captain Norman McMillan of the prior effort combined then with Colonel Broom and a Captain Stuart McLaren. They took up the effort. They were going to fly a Vickers Vulture. On the flight, they departed Calshot, Southampton, got as far as Nicholasque Bay on Bering Island in the Komondorskis. Well, additional flights set out from France, Portugal, and Argentina, and they respectively reached Shanghai, Macau, and Hanoi. So in 1924, aircraft were not fully up to the task. The Argentinians, interestingly, aided their countrymen. They set up a barrel on a busy corner in Buenos Aires and raised 160,000 pesos. A final attempt was made by Italian Antonio Locatelli. He was in a Donier Wall. His plan was to trail the U.S. effort, then surge ahead at some point. He caught up with the U.S. effort in Reykjavik, and on the next leg made a forced landing and drifted for 3 days in icy seas before being rescued by the USS Richmond, which was a support effort for the Americans. Well, the U.S. effort was promoted by the U.S. Army and Navy. Both services were hoping to sell aviation to the U.S. public, the Congress, and especially to the rest of the Army and Navy that weren't aviation. The Army Air Service took the lead with heavy logistical support from the Navy and other government and civilian agencies. Patrick and Billy Mitchell began planning. They would roughly fly the Pacific Rim, staying near the support net of Navy and other ships. 7,000 miles could have been saved by flying across Siberia, but the United States had never recognized the Soviet government and was unable to obtain permission for the flight. They would fly westerly and were timing to miss fog in Alaska, typhoons nearer Japan, and the monsoons of India. There were 6 sections for logistics, and the one of interest to us would be the Seattle segment, 3,292 miles. The entire flight was going to be 26,345 miles. Supply stations were put in place every 400 miles by the Navy. The aircraft were a modification of an existing Navy torpedo bomber manufactured by the Douglas Aircraft Company in Santa Monica. It evolved into the Douglas World Cruiser, which could use wheels or floats, The engine would be the Liberty motor of 400 horsepower. It was not the most reliable motor, had a lot of fitting failures due to vibration, but as the government had warehouses of them left over from World War I, it would do. So 50 were pulled from stocks and totally rebuilt. The plane was quite Spartan. Even at that, with 450 gallons of fuel and a reserve takeoff weight was 8,200 pounds, which if we think about the planes of that day was pretty good size. It had a cruise speed of 90 knots. Well, the Air Service then recruited single pilots and cuts were made at 50, then 25, down to 15. Finally, seven names were forwarded. Major Frederick L. Martin, age 41, was selected as the mission commander. Martin and the pilots chose their own mechanics, and all were assigned to Langley Field for 6 weeks of intense training in first aid, aerial navigation, and meteorology. When the prototype World Cruiser arrived, they began familiarization flights, and the Navy provided float training. The crew arrived at the factory. They picked up the aircraft and named them the Seattle, Chicago, Boston, and New Orleans. The official starting point was Clover Field at Santa Monica, and departure was on March 17, 1924. They hopped to Sacramento and on to Seattle with stops in Eugene and Vancouver. The spares for this segment had left Seattle mid-February, and from Seward, they were carried by a U.S. Bureau of Fisheries ship, the Eider. On March 27th, the U.S. party arrived at Unalaska. From Seattle northward, the flight would be on floats, and the preparations and weather delays held their departure, though, to April 6th. They did a stop in Prince Rupert, where some repairs were made. They were off for Sitka on April 10th, flying into very heavy mists. They passed Ketchikan at 9:35 on schedule. A watchman in the cold storage building sounded the fire alarm, and most of the residents turned out on the dock to cheer the flight, and the landing in Sitka was at 12:44. The departure had been planned, but at 0400, a storm blew in. Wave action increased. The Boston slipped anchor and crew members were taken to the aircraft by a U.S. Forest Service launch and rescued it before damage. It was then the New Orleans' turn, and it was nearly damaged on the rocks near shore. Due to time lost at Sitka, the stop in Cordova was canceled, and they flew direct to Seward on April 13th. They had clear skies, then encountered snow, until Cape Fairweather, where it was clearer. Snow was again encountered at Yakutat Bay and was quite severe near the Malaspina Glacier. Okay, we will take a quick commercial break now, so please stay with us.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
It's time for the Valdez Fishing Report. Interviews, derby standings, tips, and advice for Prince William Sound.
This is Ricky Colapietro with an update on fishing in Valdez. Jeffrey Donaldson of Fairbanks reeled in a nice salmon Saturday to kick off the Valdez Silver Salmon Derby. Donaldson's 9.06-pound silver salmon put him at the top of the leaderboard the first day of the derby and netted him the first-place daily prize July 22nd. Callie Donaldson was the second-place daily winner on Saturday and is currently in second place overall with an 8.66-pound silver salmon. Both Jeffrey and Callie were fishing aboard the Slayin AK. Krista is currently in third place overall with a 7.9-pound silver salmon she caught aboard aboard the Christa June. The Valdez Silver Salmon Derby runs now through September 3rd and features daily first and second place prizes, as well as a $10,000 grand prize for the largest silver salmon caught during the season. The cost of a derby ticket is $10, and a season ticket is $50. In addition to overall cash prizes and daily first and second place prize winners, Valdez Fish Derbies will be hosting a Women's Silver Salmon Derby August 12th. Valdez Fish Derbies is also hosting a tagged fish contest. There are 20 fish tagged in Prince William Sound, and when an angler buys a derby ticket and catches a tagged silver salmon, they have the chance to win $10,000 cash and 19 other prizes. There will also be a bonus $500 cash prize for the angler catching the largest silver on Big Prize Friday, July 28th and September 3rd.
The fishing is great in Valdez, Alaska. It's also a beautiful place to get out and explore the waters of Prince William Sound. Cast from shore or spend the day on a charter. Have your catch processed and shipped fresh right from the harbor. Stop by the Visitor Center on Fairbanks Drive for more information on accommodations, tours, events, culture, and everything Valdez has to offer. Discover more at ValdezAlaska.org.
KVAK's Valdez Fishing Report. Fish Valdez and reel in a big one.
KFAR Weather.
Scattered thunderstorms likely today. Otherwise, a mix of clouds and sun. Highs around 85. Southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Mainly cloudy skies expected tonight. Isolated thunderstorms likely. Lows level off around 62. Scattered thunderstorms again tomorrow. High temperatures reach up to 83. More clouds than sun. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Well, welcome back to KFAR's Problem Corner. So we're going to resume our discussion about, this time, the Douglas World Cruiser Around the World flight, which started in California, came up the West Coast, Alaska's southeast, south central, and out through the Aleutians on its way around the world. And again, if you'd like to call in, you can do so by dialing 458-TALK or 458-8255. Well, where we stopped, we were talking about they were in southeast. Now they're having passing fair weather. They did encounter snow at Yakutat Bay, and it was quite severe near the Malaspina Glacier. So the planes of the day had to get down at a very low level. Remember, these were equipped with floats while they were up in Alaska. Float planes in those days weren't as easy to fly as they were by World War II. There were no steam catapults. They had to be lifted off the support craft, where there were craft big enough to take them on board, set in the water, and then a traditional water takeoff was made. Landing was done on floats. But what it did, throughout Southeast particularly, it gave them a number of safe havens they could jump into and ride out bad weather if needed. Well, they passed Kayak Island as they came to Controller Bay. The weather was clearing. By Latouche, they were in clear weather. They flew over Seward in formation in the first touchdown at 3:11 in the afternoon. The others quickly followed. The next section would be to Chignik, a distance of 450 miles. The Flyers departed on the morning of April 15th at 9:45. At Point Dick, they encountered a snow squall, and the Seattle was separated from the others. After passing the Barren Islands and flying through Shelikof Straits, the Seattle was seen off of Katmai. All but the Seattle arrived at Chignik at 4:25. Due to weather, the Seattle had not been seen since the vicinity of Cape Igvec near Kanatek. Wireless communications were established between Chignik, Kanatek, Kodiak, and Seward. The Sumer steamer, Star, and the United States Navy destroyers, Corey and Hall, were all in on the net. The destroyers ran under forced draft at full speed and reached Portage Bay by 5:30 in the morning. The destroyer split with the Corey, and the Corey went on to Church around Kalagvik. The missing plane was found 3 miles south of Cape Igvec. It was anchored near shore. Martin and Harvey were well, and they had experienced an oil leak forcing a landing. The Seattle was towed to Kinnick, where Shell Oil had a drilling facility with communications and a repair shop. So again, they were getting a lot of support, not only from the Navy, the Army, other federal agencies, but civilians who in those days were just excited about aviation. Well, there was a spare motor available in Sitka, and the Corey headed there to find out the motor had been sent out on the mail ship since the flight had already passed the area. The Corey, running at full speed, was able to dock at Juneau at 9:15 in the morning on April 21st, and they were back under, had the motor loaded and were back underway by 10:30. The other aircraft were ordered to Dutch Harbor. They arrived on April 19th. The surprise arrival of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Algonquin allowed original spares to be dispatched to the Seattle. So at Dutch Harbor, the launches from the Haida recovered crews, brought them aboard, moved the aircraft into position. The aircraft at Dutch were moved up onto the beach at Unalaska to protect them from the storms that were moving through. The Boston was in need of an engine replacement and was hoisted onto the West Coast. The Alaska Commercial Company allowed the use of their facilities. Meanwhile, the Algonquin had made Kinnick with parts for the Seattle. Repairs went well, but departure was delayed until April 26th by severe weather. And at this time, 1924, most of the aviation stories we talk about, the real driver is weather. Whether you were in storms, clouds, snow, that was actually what kept you either on or off schedule, and the occasional mechanical problem with the aircraft. Well, they took off then on the 26th at 1:15 in the afternoon, made a stop on the way for weather, finally arrived at Chignik at 5:50. The prior night had been hard on the crews with an unexpected and exceptionally high tide and wind-driven wave action. The New Orleans drifted loose. The flyers and Coast Guard men worked in waist-deep surf to rescue the aircraft. The Seattle then departed Chignik at 11:10 on the 30th for the flight to Dutch and never arrived. They had last been seen flying over the Alaska Packers cannery. They were facing a strong headwind and intermittent snow. Two sightings had been made by a party of natives, the other by two fishermen. Both agreed they had been headed out over the Bering Sea. The search was switched to that side, and crews of natives also helped search the many bays in their bodegas. Martin and Henry encountered strong headwinds, turbulence, and snow. As the visibility became worse, the horizon began to disappear until they struck a 700-foot hill quite near its crest. The plane skidded 100 feet. The crew was able to depart the aircraft, amazingly unhurt. On Friday, May 2nd, they made a search of the area and had to return due to lack of shelter. On May 4th, visibility was better, and they struck out in a different direction and found a trapper's cabin on the coast about 30 miles from Point Mueller. Ready to go on, they met a group of natives who took them to Port Mueller, and they arrived at 6 in the evening on Sunday, May 10th. The cannery, owned by Pan American Fisheries, gave them lodging and radioed the news to the searchers. The two were ordered back to Washington, D.C. as soon as possible. They traveled on the Catherine D. and made Bellingham on May 25th. At this time, Martin was met by his wife and son and assigned to Chanute Airfield in Illinois. For the flyers at Dutch Harbor, those crews were ordered to continue on May 2nd with Lieutenant Lowell Smith in command. This likely in response to the fact the British effort, which we'd talked about, would soon arrive at Unalaska. On May 3rd, they departed for Nazan Bay on Atka in the Andrianoff Islands, and some of these names will sound familiar to those of you that listened to our War in the Aleutians episode two ago. And the weather was really pretty terrible throughout there. It was a 365-mile segment. It took 4.5 hours. The temperatures here necessitated the use of 50-50 alcohol water mix in the radiators. Weather was, again, quite terrible, and it delayed their departure till May the 9th, and they took a 555-mile flight to Attu. The ship's weather reports were invaluable at this time. The Navy support craft were out ahead of them. The Haida arrived on the 10th of May with the news that their companions were safe. Well, that, of course, cheered the crews up, and they were quite ready to continue going. They left Attu on Thursday, May 15th, crossed the international dateline, and were immediately on Friday, May 16th. The U.S. ships proceeded to the opposite side of Nikolsk Bay and set out refueling points for the aircraft. The Eider then went to the Russian outpost and requested to take on fresh water. Since they didn't have permission, it took a rather lengthy set of communications with the Soviet government. While this transpired, the three aircraft refueled and departed, while the Haida picked up all the buoys and refueling equipment. They proceeded safely to the Japanese island of Paramashimo, with the Soviet government being no wiser that all had been there. Well, the mission then continued on with the flyers arriving back in Sandpoint at Seattle, completing the mission on September 28th, Paramashimo being an island in Japan, so that was the last of the flight from an Alaska segment. All in all, they took 371 hours, 7 minutes of flying time over a period of 175 days and covered 26,345 miles. This was a very early effort. A lot of the things we see in looking at the time seems kind of like it wasn't much of a deal, but it certainly in 1924 was. And we'll be looking now at some other aviation. Let's bring it back to Fairbanks. Early aviation in Fairbanks' first flights. Well, as December, of course, 1903, Orville and Wilbur Wright made the first successful powered aircraft flight on a North Carolina beach. That first flight lasted only a few seconds. Improved aircraft and engines followed rapidly and steadily. The first airplane flight in Alaska was at Fairbanks. Only a few years after the North Carolina flight, some merchants in Fairbanks decided that a demonstration flight there could pay for itself. They arranged for James V. Lilly and Lilly Martin to bring their airplane from Seattle for such a flight on July 4th, 1913. The Martins shipped their crated aircraft from... Okay, and ladies and gentlemen, we are going to take a break for Fox News at this time. Please stay with us. Thank you.
coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
This is Fox News Alert. I'm John Saucier. Looks like there will be no plea deal for Hunter Biden after all. A federal judge questioned the constitutionality of the one he had in place, so instead he pleads not guilty on two tax crimes. House Republicans say the Biden administration is weaponizing the Department of Justice to protect President Biden and his son Hunter. House Republican Conference Chair Elise Stefanik says they'll leave no stone unturned in the investigation.
With each passing day, House Republicans' investigations uncover more and more evidence showing that Joe Biden not only knew about, but was involved in his family's illegal influence peddling scheme and the cover-up from the weaponized Department of Justice.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre just said that President Biden stands by his son, Hunter. Two whistleblowers coming forward said there was political interference in these investigations. America's listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports that a Doyon Limited subsidiary was fined a total of $117,000 by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for violating the Clean Air Act with disregard to the installation of emission control devices on its vehicles, according to an EPA news release. Doyon Associated LLC, which specializes in Arctic pipeline construction, was fined for installing 55 defeat devices and tampering with 28 heavy-duty motor vehicles throughout 2019. Defeat devices interfere or disable a vehicle's emissions controls. According to the EPA, Doyon's actions equated to putting approximately 280 new vehicles on the road. The manufacturer, sale, and installation of defeat devices is against the law, said Ed Kowalski, EPA Region 10's Director of Enforcement and Compliance. By installing devices that defeat the manufacturer-installed air emissions control systems, the company bypassed a system designed to protect the public's health. Doyon issued a statement acknowledging that employees
streaming
made a mistake.
Online at KFAR660.com.
Nowadays, nothing is more important than saving money. And the best way to do that is with the radio station's 50-50 Friday offer. Every week, a different special from a different local business offering gift certificates at half price. All from your favorite restaurants, shops, and events. So what's this week's 50-50 Friday offer?
This week's 50-50 deal is the all-new Fairbanks Laundry, your brand-new state-of-the-art laundromat. Now open daily 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. at 906 Old Steese Highway, boasting a massive 6,000-square-foot self-service laundry facility with a variety of washers and dryers to suit every load size. Your laundry will be ready in no time. This week, get a $50 user card from Fairbanks Laundry for half price. Fairbanks Laundry, where clean clothes are just a spin cycle away.
Just log on to this station's website and click on that red 50-50 tag in the upper right-hand corner. Have your credit card ready and get ready to save big. 50-50 Friday, every Friday at 9 a.m. from the radio station.
Feeling uneasy about your financial future? You need a partner that helps lighten the load. Welcome to Global Credit Union. It means early payday, your paycheck up to 3 days early with direct deposit, accounts with no NSF fees, and a mobile app with tools to help you manage your family budget. At Global, we take member care seriously with branches near you and a 24/7 U.S.-based call center staffed by real people. Join us at globalcu.org. Global Credit Union.
Spend your Saturdays with KFAR Radio for local programs, starting with Alaska Realty Today from Next Home Arctic Sun Realty at 11 a.m. The Buzz at 11:30, brought to you by the Tanana Herb Company, followed by Health Talk with Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical at noon. And then it's the Compos Outdoor Show at 12:30, Fairbanks Foodies at 1 p.m., and Explore Fairbanks at 1:30. All 3 hours of local shows can be found on the KFAR website in the archives section. Weekends just got local with KFAR Radio.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Okay, welcome back to KFAR's Problem Corner. We're going to resume our discussion about some early Alaskan aviation events. We just spent the first half of the program talking about the Douglas Around the World flight, and it was quite an event. See that a lot of Alaska, a lot of people turned out along the coast to help the flight. Well, now we're moving on to Fairbanks. Certainly had some very early aviation here. The first flight took place here in 1913. And the Martins shipped their crated plane from Seattle to Skagway by an ocean steamer, then from Skagway to Whitehorse, and to Fairbanks by steamboat. This was the first appearance of an airplane in Alaska, and it demonstrated how interdependent various means of transportation were and would be in the future. The plane they had was a standard, and it simply could not do, or they did not trust it to do, any of the longer flight segments. Once at Fairbanks, Martin and his wife, who was, by the way, England's first woman aviator, assembled the plane. On the evening of July 3rd, Martin took off from a ballpark and flew the plane over Fairbanks at an altitude of 200 feet and speeds of up to 45 miles per hour. Later, the Martins lectured on flying at the Fairbanks Opera House. The couple made 5 flights in 3 days at Fairbanks. During that time, they tried unsuccessfully to sell their plane to a group of businessmen, and since it couldn't be sold, they crated it up again and shipped it via St. Michael by steamer to their home in San Francisco. The trip wasn't particularly a good payer for them, because a lot of Fairbanksans, who, as we know, were all pretty frugal people, found out they could watch the airplane fly without having to enter the fairgrounds that they were operating out of and got a free view. Well, in 1920 then, 7 years later, is the next time that aviation came to Alaska, Fairbanks, and we talked about this on one of our earlier segments. We were able to kind of go over the history of that whole flight. Two major personalities contributed to that flight of 1920. One would be General William Billy Mitchell and Captain St. Clair Street. Mitchell had served in the Philippines, where he was the acting chief signal officer on General Arthur MacArthur's staff. After the war, Mitchell was asked by General Greely to go to Alaska and inspect progress on the Washington-Alaska Military Cable and Telegraph System, the Womcats. He did this in the summer of 1901. His conclusion was better progress could actually be made in the winter with the solid frozen ground. He returned in the fall of 1901 and remained here until 1905. His time in Alaska is covered in some memoirs he wrote called The Opening of Alaska, which likely wasn't written until 1935. Mitchell's main focus was the line from Fort Liscum near Valdez to Fort Egbert at Eagle. He and his troop, with help from native guides, also located the route from Eagle to the Tanana by way of the Good Pasture Drainage. A lot of times you'll hear people say Billy Mitchell built the Womcats. He did not. He had a very influential part, particularly in the interior, by realizing that winter construction was better than summer construction. But he was not on the entire route, just the Valdez to Eagle segment. Well, after his Alaska time, Mitchell became one of the most vocal proponents of air power, and in 1919, he became the assistant chief of the Army Air Service. He often arranged flights to keep aviation in the public eye. The most ambitious was a flight of 4 de Havilland DH-4B aircraft to undertake a flight from Long Island, New York, to Nome. We will probably in the future have to cover Billy Mitchell as an entire segment. His connections to Alaska went on first as a Signal Corps officer, certainly made a lot of contributions there. Then as chief of the Army, assistant chief of the Army Air Force, he was very set on Alaska's strategic importance and the fact that aviation events in Alaska should be promoted, and certainly, remember, he made the statement to Congress that he who holds Alaska holds the world. Well, that flight back to the 1920 flight was known officially as the Alaska Flying Expedition. It was given the moniker of the Black Wolf Squadron. It was under command of St. Clair Street, an Army aviator who had served during the First World War. The Army set out and modified four DH-4, which was a de Havilland. They were developed as bombers, and they built them to what they called DH-4B status with the same 400 horsepower 12-cylinder Liberty engines that the Navy had used in the Douglas World Cruisers. When loaded, they weighed about 4,600 pounds, so just about half what the World Cruiser did. This engine turned an 8-foot prop, had a cruising speed of 90 miles an hour and a top speed of 115 when things were working right. The flight started from Mitchell Field near Hempstead, Long Island on July 15, 1920. It was a day with rain, mist, and muddy field conditions. Plane number 3 with Lieutenant Crumrin spun into a bog, had to wait to the next day to join the others. Due to inclement weather, the 3 remaining aircraft had to fly as low as 500 feet. So they got to the West Coast with some adventures and some misadventures. And on Friday, August 13th, so we know they weren't superstitious, they departed St. George and followed the railroad to Hazelton and Barron's Airport. The flyers stayed until noon the following day, awaiting better weather. They crossed the coastal range at 10,000 feet to avoid the mountains lurking in the undercast skies. When they arrived on the coast, Stewart Arm was spotted. They made their way to Wrangell. As the first aircraft landed, the others thought they saw dust, which turned out to be water from the incoming tide. They were all moved to higher ground and greeted by a huge crowd of well-wishers as the mayor had declared a city holiday. On Monday the 16th, 3 of the aircraft departed successfully, but Street was detained by the rising tide. He then ended up flying on Tuesday, and on Monday, Lieutenant Kilpatrick had made Juneau history. The town had turned out as word of the flight had been telephoned ahead from an observer in Thane. Kirkpatrick approached low up Franklin Street, and at 2:30 in the afternoon, he dropped the first parcel of airmail to be delivered to Juneau. The aircraft proceeded to Skagway, followed the White Pass and Yukon route, crossing the coastal range a second time to Whitehorse. Around noon on the 16th, 3 of the 4 biplanes lumbered into Whitehorse to a near whole town reception. To accommodate the aircraft, a strip of land was cleared in the area that would eventually become the Erik Nielsen International Airport. 3 aircraft had flown on ahead to be the first to land in Whitehorse. These preparations had taken place earlier. Captain Douglas of the Army Aircraft, or the Army Air Service, had been there. He was their front man, did a lot for them before they had to get there. And Captain H.A. LeRoyer of the Canadian Air Board traveled to Whitehorse solely to talk over a proposed international aeroplane flight to Nome in Alaska. The 2 traveled on to Dawson at 3 p.m. that same day, arriving in time for the celebration of gold discovery on August 17, 1896. Well, the flight could plainly see the survey and telegraph lines Mitchell had helped cut 20 years before. After 2 hours 45 minutes, the Black Wolf Squadron landed in Fairbanks, and that was at noon on the 20th, and then flew on to Ruby around 3 p.m. that day. They were greeted by Captain Douglas and a crowd of hundreds. That night, they were treated to a banquet hosted by the Pioneers of Alaska, Igloo No. 5, who also helped move oil and gasoline to the landing site. Weather held them up. Many miners and trappers visited to see the group. The planes touched down on the old parade ground then after they left Ruby, and at the abandoned Fort Davis, which is 3 miles east of Nome in those days at the mouth of the Nome River, and they landed at 5:30 p.m. on August 23rd. They returned then back east. The Black Wolf Squadron took 40 days, flew 4,502 miles in 50 flying hours. Much of their route was used later during the Second World War as the Lend-Lease route to Alaska or to Siberia. St. Clair Strait wired for permission to cross the straits into Siberia. The State Department had to decline, partially due to the foreign intervention going on during the Russian Revolution. Okay, we are going to go into another commercial break at this point. Please stay with us. We'll return shortly.
Our Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Did you know that hot weather is worse for your car than cold? It's true. Extreme heat can evaporate your battery's fluids and cause corrosion. If you're having a hard time starting your engine, visit Batteries Plus. We'll test your battery free of charge. We have plenty of replacement batteries on hand. Plus, we offer installation on most makes and models, or upgrade to premier installation for added protection. Stop by your nearest location or shop our selection online at batteriesplus.com.
Your home is the place where you know your loved ones are secure. But the things that keep your home protected can't keep pests at bay. That's where Raid comes in. For 60 years, Raid scientists have worked to protect people around the world with trusted research, ingredients, testing standards, and product efficacy. Raid seeks to create a better future for all, especially the ones you love most. Raid, protection for all.
School on!
Back to school is on, and Staples has great prices on everything you need for your best year yet. Save on notebooks. Save on headphones and laptops. Save on pens, markers, and all the essentials. And right now at Staples, save up to 60% on select notebooks, markers, and more. School on, save on at Staples, where school savings are always in session. N729. Prices may vary in-store and online.
Your Alaska home takes care of you. The Woodway helps you care for your home. Take control of your summer lawn and garden care projects with reliable outdoor power equipment from Honda, Husqvarna, and Steel. Mowers, trimmers, water pumps, chainsaws, and cultivators. Back up your home power supply or light up your camp with an ultra-quiet Honda generator. Homeowner to pro, buy your outdoor power equipment at The Woodway on College Road. Caring for your home the Alaskan way. The right way. The Woodway.
Weather brought to you by the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks. Your eyes connect you to your world. Care for them with the Eye Clinic of Fairbanks, your eye health professionals on Mini Street.
KFAR weather.
Partly cloudy today with scattered thunderstorms likely. High temperatures reach up to 85. Winds out of the southeast around 5 miles an hour. Isolated thunderstorms again tonight. Lows around 62. Mainly cloudy. Mainly cloudy skies tomorrow. Scattered thunderstorms likely. 83. That's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Derek Height.
And now, more Problem Corner on
Welcome back, everyone, to KFAR's Problem Corner. We are going to resume our discussion about some early Alaskan and Fairbanks aviation events with myself. If you'd like to call in, you can do so by dialing 458-TALK or 458-8255. We will try to get to your call. Well, the next event that I'm going to talk about was the 1929 New York to Nome flight by Captain Ross G. Hoyt, U.S. Army Air Corps. This is a really, I think, enjoyable flight to look at after we look at the Black Wolf Squadron. It shows in 9 years how much aircraft had improved and what could be done even with small pursuit, which we call fighters today, so the P series of airplanes, what they could actually do by this time. On January 1st, 1929, a An Army transport, a C-2-3, took off from Los Angeles and did not land until January the 7th. It spent 150 hours, 50 minutes, 40 seconds aloft. The aircraft was named the Question Mark and had a crew of four, including Chief Pilot Captain Hoyt. They had 43 successful aerial refueling contracts. So now we see the airplanes are able to stay in the air mechanically. The Army and Navy, for that matter, were looking for ways to increase range. Larger fuel tanks simply took up too much room and added too much weight to the aircraft. So now they're practicing this now brand new idea of air-to-air refueling, which was usually just a hose dropped from one aircraft to the other. Crewmen would grab it, put it in the tank, and turn it on. The aircraft would refuel. And that is a pretty crude way of doing it compared to what our friends out at Eielson in the refueling squadron do. Well, it didn't have a lot to do with Alaskan aviation, that particular flight, but Captain Hoyt would soon be known in the North. Hoyt would be the pilot of an endurance flight from New York to Nome in a single-seat pursuit aircraft, which was an XP-6B built by the Curtiss Aircraft Company. It was powered by a Curtiss V-1570 12-cylinder 600-horsepower motor. It could cruise at 150 knots and was fitted with additional fuel tanks for a total of 258 gallons. Hoyt was a career Army aviator. He was stationed at Langley Field, Virginia. This flight was planned as a round-trip dash from Mitchell Field to San Francisco with a return in less than 48 hours. And that flight was made moot when an Army Reserve pilot, Captain Frank Hawks, flew from New York to Los Angeles in less than 36 hours in a Lockheed Air Express. So he kind of stole his compatriot's thunder a little bit. So they came up with a new plan. The plan announced on July 15, 1929, was for an 8,460-mile round trip from Mitchell Field, New York, to Nome, Alaska, and return. There would be refueling stops at Minneapolis, Edmonton, Whitehorse, and Fairbanks. With all expedited plans, everything was set and ready to go by July the 18th, 1929. After a very short ceremony, the aircraft was christened the New Alaska. Hoyt was airborne at 2:39 on the afternoon of the 18th. He carried three thermoses, one with water, one with orange juice, and the third had a mixture of milk and raw eggs. Interesting combination. The flight was timed to take advantage of the summer solstice. He planned to reach Minneapolis in less than 7 hours. Lake Erie was reached at 4:09. The east shoreline of Lake Michigan around 7 p.m. and his destination just about an hour later. His average speed had been 141 knots, 219 gallons of gasoline were burned. He refueled and departed for Edmonton, 1,100 miles distant. And at 9:15 or so, he ran into rain, which he dodged. And at 3:30 a.m., he had a local dawn, which faint but began to crack. He picked up a railroad, which he followed into Edmonton, arriving very early on July 19th. Hoyt had breakfast and planned to depart for Whitehorse as soon as possible. The departure was only 1 hour 45 minutes after arrival, and it's a 1,090-mile segment. Hoyt ran into strong headwinds, reached Hazleton after 4 hours, turned back to Vanderhoof, refueled, and awaited better conditions. He landed there at 1400, and after a night's worth of sleep, departed at 0400, until he reached Lake Atlin. The flying weather was poor, with clouds, winds, and turbulence from the terrain. At Lake Atlin, he was able to confirm course. He flew on to Whitehorse and arrived at 7:30 in the morning, 5.5 hours after takeoff. 2 hours later, he was on his way to Fairbanks, 500 miles distant by direct course, landed at Weeks Field a couple of minutes after noon, a flight of 3 hours, 22 minutes. Most of the town was alerted by radio, and a lot of people showed up. Hoyt had lunch with Mayor Frank de la Verne and C.L. Thompson of Bennett Rodabaugh Company. They took motion pictures to be sent back for newsreels. Hoyt discussed the weather with the locals and decided to make Nome refuel and return directly to Fairbanks, where he could rest. After 4.5 hours, he reached Nome at 5 p.m. He spent only 70 minutes at Nome, returned to Fairbanks, arriving after 3.5 hours at 11:30. He had flown 2,200 miles on this one day. He took a few hours sleep, only four, departed Fairbanks for Whitehorse at 5:10 in the morning of July 21st. Arrival there was at 9:15. He was back in the air at 11 and expected to reach Moore Edmonton early in the evening. He flew for 700 miles in broken weather, finally passed over Prince George. He was following the railroad at an altitude of 6,000 feet. Halfway between there and Jasper, Alberta, the engine began to sputter and lose power. Hoyt chose to make an emergency landing in a clearing. It was soft sand, one wheel dug in, and the aircraft flipped, breaking some spars. Well, Hoyt then was able, with a group of local people, to right the aircraft and assess the damage, realized it couldn't be repaired on site. He sent a telegram to his superiors. A Curtis aircraft representative from Edmonton took charge of recovery. Hoyt departed by rail on July 23rd with everything of value he could salvage. Hoyt had not only set a record from New York to Nome, but had proven the concept of air ferry of pursuit planes over a long distance. This very concept was of great value in 11 years when numerous aircraft were shipped to the USSR by this route. So if we look at Hoyt's flight and the times, July 19th through the 23rd, and think about just 9 years prior, it had taken 54 days to do the same flight. So we can really see the rapid improvement in aircraft at that time and exactly what could be done.
Very good.
Well, thanks, Dave. I'm glad you jumped in with us.
Better be late than not at all.
You know, I'm always happy when you're here.
Okay. Did you enjoy that?
I did.
Yeah. Where did you get your research from?
Came from a number of sources. The U.S. Air Force had the Navy flight was covered. There's been a book or two out about it. And on the Naval Aviation History pages, you can find out a bit. The Air Force parts, the Army Air Corps, came from another of them, number of other books, one of which is just simply Alaskan Aviation. And I didn't bring the that reference with me today. But
say goodbye and wrap up.
Okay, and it is time to wrap up. Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be on again.